Part 31, Chapter 4. After glancing over the flying conditions, Johnny could not much blame Pierre. For a while now, they had been flying through the night, a fact which an experienced instrument pilot would not have thought about twice, and indeed, Johnny had scarcely noticed it. By looking very hard, and only then with trained pilot's eyes, one could just barely make out Mount Elgon rising above the black cloud carpet, for there was no moon, and such a peak became mainly visible because it blocked out certain stars. It was the screens which caused Johnny to forgive Pierre. So thick was the cloud layer below them that the view screens, aimed at it, were more snowstorm than image. You would actually have to know the shape of the lake and the compound to have any notion of what you were looking at. A lot of electrostatic disturbance. It must be raining like fury at the compound. Rain flicked with lightning. Pierre, however, was in a state of mind that wasn't asking for anything but to stand on solid ground. He could not read the screens. He could not see anything but some stars above them and blackness below them, a blackness lashed now and then by some internal flash. He thought they were done for if they tried to go down through that. Who knew what hill they would run into? He would have been petrified had he known that Mount Elgon was higher than they were flying, but mercifully, he did not know that. Nor, even more frightening, that they had passed by a couple of peaks even higher. Magnifying his alarm, Monsieur Tyler had come back to the pilot seat and hummed a strange song. Mon Dieu, one did not sing when one faced certain death. Lunacy. Victoria gave them permission to land, and Johnny felt his way down through the rain clouds. His screens didn't clear up, but knowing the area, he could identify the scraps of image he sometimes glimpsed. It was useless to look through the screen. It looked like it had a fire hose being played on it. Johnny felt for the ground with his skids, more concerned about a bump affecting his passengers than about where he was. He did it very smoothly, and Pierre was again alarmed when Johnny turned off the motors. He thought they were still in the air. The rain was actually making it hard to talk in the cab of the plane. Johnny threw open the door, and there was Kerr standing there, water cascading off him in the plane lights. Even allowing for the deluge, Kerr was awfully glum-looking. He was usually very glad to see Johnny. The last time Johnny had been in Africa, he and Kerr had spent 3 nights working the Kariba rig. The planet Phobia had been very elusive. They had no coordinates for it beyond somewhere around the cyclo sun. And for a while, it had seemed they would never discover it, and Kerr would eventually die from having no breathe gas. The planet was, however, located. It was doing a squashed ellipse. Phobia's perihelion, the point in its orbit where it was nearest its sun, was so much closer to its sun than its aphelion, the point in its orbit where it was farthest. And the distance to its sun from these two points was so vastly different, near and far, that anyone trying to live on Phobia would have perished, even a cyclo. Phobia went through 3 states. As it swung away from its sun, its atmosphere chilled and became liquid. As its distance increased, the liquid froze to solidity. As it again approached its sun, the sequence reversed and the atmosphere became gaseous again. But this long period of having a summer, and the Phobia year was about 83 of Earth's, permitted moss and other plants to grow, and these flourished for a time and then, as the atmosphere liquefied, remained in a state of suspended animation until summer came again. Although they had an awful time with camera triangulation to estimate its orbit, the end product had been beyond Kerr's wildest dreams. The planet was well into autumn, and it was no real trick to pump huge cable tanks full of liquid breathe gas. Not only that, but they had brought back about 50 tons of the material needed to make real goo food. Yes, Kerr had been acting like a cyclo gone to heaven. A most unlikely event. When Johnny and he had last met, and here he stood, glum in the rain.
Hello, Johnny,
he said woodenly.
What's the matter with you?
Lost your loaded dice?
Oh, it's not you, Johnny. I'm always glad to see you. It's that Maz. He was chief engineer here when the place was operating. One of the wounded ones. I got about 70 ex-prisoners from all over, and I'm trying to earn my pay by getting this tungsten mine going again.
He moved nearer, the rain cascading down his breathe gas mask, his tunic sodden with the hot rain that battered him.
I'm no engineer!
He suddenly wailed.
I was an operations officer. We ran out of ore body, and the next one is just beyond it someplace. That...
blank.
Maz. And all those other...
blank. Blank.
Cyclos just sit down there on their butts and gloom. Some...
blank.
Fool showed them the pictures of Cyclo blowing up, and they just won't do anything. I don't know any...
blank. Blank. Blank.
Mav? And I can't calculate the next ore deposits.
That's two of us, thought Johnny. He was glad the girls didn't speak Cyclo. The ex-underworld midget could really swear. But he almost never did, unless he was terribly upset.
That's why I'm here.
Really?
Kerr brightened up like a mine charge had gone off in him.
Has McKendrick arrived?
Control got a drone report on a plane from Scotland. That McKendrick? He'd be about 3 hours behind you.
3 hours? Johnny had wanted to get to work right away. Well, there was something else he had to do first anyway. Get some Cyclo corpses.
There's people in the back. Do me a favor and get them into the compound.
Right,
said Kerr, cheered up. He had a folded mine tarp on his arm he could use on the others as a rain shield. He sloshed toward the rear door, unfolding it. Pierre had been recovering, but now he was horrified to find that Johnny was rummaging around in a locker for high-altitude suits.
Here!
Johnny threw one at him and began to pull on another one. Johnny heard the door slam in back and saw dim figures running toward the compound in the rain. He finished zipping up his suit and checked his fuel. Plenty. 20 seconds later, they were hurtling into the sky again. Pierre was still struggling into the unfamiliar high-altitude suit. Mon Dieu, life around Monsieur Tyler was hair-raising. Johnny was unperturbed about it all. Up above the rain clouds, the screens were clean, and by seeing what stars were emitted, he could even eyeball the peaks. He left the plane lights on, heading for the glacial snows where they had left the Cyclo corpses. He needed two, he thought, a workman and an executive. It did not help Pierre's frame of mind at all not to be told where they were going, nor why. Charging into the ink at such speeds appalled him. He did not even look at the view screens. His eyes were riveted through the now streaked windscreen. Very shortly, Johnny was in the right location. He knew they had left a forklift up here. He would use that to guide in. He supposed that after all this time, the corpses would be pretty well covered with snow. But Pierre, not knowing what was being looked for or where or why, simply looked through the windscreen, his eyes dilated with something that was getting up close to terror. Suddenly, Pierre saw a whiteness. It had puffs blowing off it in the plane lights. With horror, he heard the engines wind down for a landing.
Don't!
He screamed.
Don't! Don't! You're landing on a cloud!
Johnny glanced up through the view screen. It did look like a cloud at that, seen from this angle. A high wind was blowing snow about. Ah, there was the forklift. Up to its seat in snow and ice. The corpses would be lying, covered up, just beyond it. He had been flying by screens only. They were a long way from the nearest drop-off. He let the ship crunch down into the snow and shut off the motors. The wind was screaming up here, enough to make the plane tremble. Johnny settled his air mask on tighter.
Get out and give me a hand!
Pierre was in a total confusion. He had clearly seen them land on a cloud, and he could not understand what was holding the ship up. He knew from their earlier course that they must be close to, if not on, the Earth's equator. And recent studies had told him that the equator was very hot. So snow was the furthest thing from his imagination. His small tribe had been under the domination of Jesuit priests, and they had controlled by instilling a heavy fear of heaven and hell, mostly the latter. The reputation of Monsieur Tyler was itself a matter of growing superstition and awe. It surprised him less that they had landed on a cloud than it did to be told to get out. Pierre looked at the puffs of white in the ship's light. Yes, a cloud. He fingered the image of a crucified Christ that hung about his neck. He felt he was too young to be a martyr. But there was a solution. He snatched the jet backpack from the compartment behind the seat and hastily shrugged into it. Monsieur Tyler quite probably was able to walk on clouds, but that didn't include Madame Solens's son, Pierre. It took a lot of courage to open the door, but he did so. He closed his eyes tightly and sprang out, hand on the backpack firing trigger. It was about 8 feet down from a seat of such a plane to the ground, but Pierre had been nerved up to fall 12,000. When he hit the ground, despite snow, he almost broke his legs. Pierre fell backward in total confusion and lay propped on his elbows in the snow. He could not understand why he had not fallen through the cloud. Johnny, intent on his project, was oblivious of all this confusion. He had taken a mine crowbar from the plane's toolkit and was prospecting through the snow for the corpses. They certainly were covered up. The tip of the iron bar found one. He knelt and brushed away some snow, the particles flying away in the wind. He uncovered the tip of a breathe gas mask, and then the ornament of a cap. Yep, an executive. He felt around under the monstrous shoulders to see where he had to insert the flat end of the crowbar to pry the monster loose from the adhesions of ice. One of these cyclos weighed about 1,000 pounds, more in all this snow and ice. Johnny inserted the crowbar deeper and heaved down on it. The monster was so stuck that the top end of the bar slipped and tore open his high-altitude jacket fastenings. He tried again, this time giving it all the strength he had. With a creaking, low-pitched sound, the monster moved upward. But the sound must have been close to that of clearing one's throat. The Banks singing button in his pocket gave out a ballad line with a baritone voice. Pierre, already badly shaken, beheld a demon rising from out of the cloud. And not only that, it was singing in a sepulchral voice. It was a lot too much. With a low moan, he fainted dead away